Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Toddcast. In this week's Meet the Press Reports, we're kicking off our year-long coverage of the midterms through the prism of what we call county to county. It's a deep dive into seven counties that will help us understand the American political electorate, which way they moved, different groups. Think of it as almost our pre-exit poll of trying to understand who's voting and why they're voting and will they vote. So joining me today is Dante Chin. He's the director of the American Communities Project. He's the brain behind Data Download. And frankly, he's the brain behind, or he's certainly the inspiration behind our coverage doing this from the county level. So Dante, as always, sir, welcome back to the Toddcast.
It's good to be here.
Look, I maybe you have this data fresh on your head, but like one of the things that one of the rationales I give publicly as to why we do this way, county to county, not like embed in a state or this or that, is that we just don't live next door to each other anymore. You know, right? I know people, you know, look, I fully remember the street I lived on, and nobody knew what the politics were of anybody. And in fact, in my neighborhood, we were one of those, nobody ever had yard signs. God, you know, I think every once in a while, I remember my dad put on a bumper sticker once for somebody running for office because it was a client. But you know, it was like one of those things, just people that didn't do it. You sort of, and we knew we were a swing area. Dade County, Miami-Dade is, you know,
yep.
In the 80s really was, you know, and still, as we learned from our county to county project, still has some swinging tendencies to it because it's such a large county. Are there swing counties? You know, we have found a few. There are not that many swing big counties anymore, are there?
No, there really aren't. And to me, you're right. I mean, I think the reason we do this is it lets us take something that we're really comfortable with, which is kind of talking about, because we do with polls, talk about demographic breaks. We're going to get a poll soon in the next couple days here, and we're going to look at things like, okay, what's the white vote? What's the black vote? What's the college educated white vote? What does it look like with different age groups? And that's a really good, it's wonderful. It's one of the things we like about poll data. But like what we do with this county stuff that we're doing is we're able to find places that kind of accentuate those points that we see in the poll. And the really cool thing is because we are kind of tribalized and increasingly living around like-minded people, you can go to a place and study, okay, let's look at like somewhat conservative college-educated whites. Let's look at young people. Let's look at the African-American vote. You know, let's look at the evangelical vote. And you can do it in a place. The stuff that we do in a poll, you can do in a place. And when you do it in a place, First of all, you can watch what happens with the results in that place, and you can go to the place and talk to the people and really get a feel of how a community that's really has a lot of that particular kind of voter, what it thinks about the election.
If I were to put a theme as to why we picked the seven counties we picked, I would put the theme under this umbrella, Dante, and I'm curious if you concur, which is we're really just trying to find out what are the tension points in each coalition. You know, we're trying to figure out, can Democrats keep this pretty large coalition of progressives and suburbanites in the same umbrella? And is the only way to do it through the prism of Trump? And can Republicans figure out how to stop losing college educated voters, and also keep Donald Trump in the tent, right? And because in many ways, those are the premises we're testing, right? And we're also trying to figure out, can the Democratic coalition be geographically monolithic, or do they need to improve in some rural places? So, I guess that's not an umbrella. That's multiple umbrellas there.
right. Yeah.
Let's break down sort of what, you know, if you look at the three light blue to dark blue counties we're looking at Washoe County, which is a swing county that Democrats have to carry when they win elections in Nevada. So that's why we don't count it as a swing county.
Right.
We have Anson County, a rural county that has a Democratic lean to it. And these are, whether it's African-American or Hispanic voters, it does seem as if geography is starting to trump ethnic and racial lines here a little bit. How hard? That's what we're trying to find out. And then, of course, young voters. You know, when they're engaged, watch out.
Yeah.
We've seen that. But when they're not engaged, that's when the Republicans do well, particularly in a place like Wisconsin. So that seems to be the basic tension points. What else would you extrapolate out of those three?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the main points in those places. I guess the other thing I'd say is for a place like Washoe, like it
It Reno, is Nevada, by the way.
Yeah. Greater Reno, I guess we can call it. The thing I'd say looking there is that like it is still swingy, but it's voted Democratic in every presidential election since 2004. And it
feels like it's moving.
Yes, right? It is. It really is. It's in motion, and it's already on the blue side, and it's falling more blue is what it feels.
Yeah, it's sort of like Reno's. I thought you said our reporter there, Guad Venegas, made an interesting observation to you. He said this feels like Phoenix 10 years ago.
Yeah, that was like
Reno is going to be the next Phoenix. Yeah,
and if you've been down there, because I was in Phoenix 10 years ago, and you could feel some of that happening there. Yeah. And even the way he was describing, like because he's there and he was doing it. I need to get out to these places and see them, because actually I had a conversation with him, and my takeaway was like, oh my god, I got to get out to Washoe. This sounds fascinating.
Yeah, no,
lots of construction
economy.
Right, right. Back to me.
You know, it's so funny. It was Clark and Washoe and nothing else in Nevada. Now you realize, boy, Washoe is just a different entity. This is not the casino driven economy that Reno had basically had to, you know, Reno was sort of the poor man's Vegas. Well, now they've diversified their economy in a great way.
Yeah. Well, and they're seeing a lot of stuff we saw, you know, talk about Phoenix a decade ago, maybe 15 years ago now. Mm-hmm. You know, what are we seeing? It's like massive growth, lots of construction. You know, tech and jobs and moving
California's coming in for cheaper, absolutely. For cheaper land.
Absolutely. And it's changing. It's really changing that place. So, I mean, so Washoe is really interesting to me. It's to me, it's a question of Democratic margin there. I think a lot of the places we're looking at, it's
are all about margins.
They're really all about margins. Yeah. They really are. So I saw somebody like on the Twitters talking about like, these are not good. These are not good. Bellwether counties is like,
These are not Bellwether counties.
Yeah. We're studying different segments of the electorate. But I do think even we're talking about like, you know, Washoe, there is this component of what Democratic turnout's going to look like. But then there's also this question of there's a lot of swing voters there. Dane, when you get up to Madison, Wisconsin, or up around the University of Wisconsin, that's all turnout. That's are the young voters tuned in? Are they paying attention? Are they going to come
out? They don't always tune into midterms, right?
No, like, I got to tell you, man. In 2010, I was in Bloomington, Indiana, and I was working on something similar to this. And like, they were completely unaware. That was Baron. Who was that? It's a Baron. Who was that down there? I forget. I want to say Baron Davis, but I don't think so. That's a basketball player. But it was a race down there, and they were not. Are you guys planning on voting? Like, no. What? There's an election. They were not tuned in at all. So that's a huge issue in those places. And then I think Anson, the thing that's really interesting there is, you go to these communities, particularly like this in the South, and that's a 50-50 county in terms of black and white. It's about 49% black, 49% white, and a little bit of Hispanic in there. And when you go to a place like that, divisions are so stark.
Yeah.
So it's two things. Like both, you're looking at, is black turnout get up in those places, and does white turnout get up in those places? Mm-hmm. And when white and black turnout both rise, that really is like, it's Republican and Democratic turnout. They're just so sharply divided along race and party. They're really interesting places.
What I loved about already Antonia Hilton's reporting already, just how she's already identified why we're there, which is how African-American voters in rural counties don't feel like the Democratic Party talks to them more directly, right? Like this is one of those that unfortunately the Democratic Party's decided we're an urban suburban party, and they forget they do have rural voters. Right?
Yes,
and I think the reason why are we there? The reason North Carolina, when Democrats win federal elections in North Carolina, i.e., Senate or presidential, it's because they do better in among these rural minority counties that are along the border of South Carolina. It's sort of the start of the Black Belt.
Yep.
And when they don't, they don't win those places, right? And
exactly.
They've lost some close races, and they win the governor's races, but those are slightly different in North Carolina.
Yep,
they seem to struggle in these federal races when they don't talk to every corner of the electorate. And, you know, Antonio noted, they're still waiting for broadband in Anson. It's like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me, guys? Come on, man.
This is a real story in rural America. And like, so when you're talking about like the African-American vote in Anson and a lot of those border counties, the southern border of North Carolina, it's the same story. It's not like the rural black voters in there, I think, are going to vote Republican, but they may not turn out. Right.
That's
this is the question of what are you doing for me? What are you doing for me?
Right.
Right. And then the really interesting thing is then you go to Dane County, and it's the same thing for them. It's college educated, like kids in college. And are they going to show up? And the thing that's really interesting is what those kids want in Dane County and what the, I shouldn't say kids, what the college students want in Dane County and what the voters want in Anson County are very, very different. Very different. And how do you balance those things through the Democratic Party? Look, they're not worried about broadband in Dane. I'll tell you that much. Around Madison, there's plenty of broadband up there. Different issues.
So the shade, the three of the sort of our leaning counties, we have one outside of Columbus, Ohio, Delaware County. That's probably my, you know, of all the three that I'm obsessed with on the red side of the column. Yep. That's the one that's number one on my list. Lucerne, which is in the Scranton, Wilkes-Barre market. It's Pennsylvania. It's more of a, you know, is this movement of Union Democrats to the Republican Party continuing? And then of course the evangelical county that we've identified in Chattooga in Georgia. And really that is in some ways the polar opposite of Dane County, right?
Yes.
Do these voters care about voting in midterms when Trump's name is not on the ballot, right? They're in some ways the mirror image of the college voter.
Absolutely.
What else do you want to grab from these three counties?
So the thing that's super interesting to me about Delaware, because I'm the same. Look, I've been going to Delaware since 2016. I've been going there and focusing. And I thought we'd see way more movement than we saw there. And in 2016, Trump still won it by 16 points, which is still a little.
We're eventually right.
Right. Yeah. Sure. But it just took another 4 years. So I'm really curious to watch the Senate race there and to see like what those voters think, because those are moderate Republican voters. And I'm really curious to see them. And then Luzerne is really interesting to me because, look, Luzerne's going to go Republican. I do think if you talk about like these are the former Reagan Democrats who became not completely comfortable with the Republican Party, who kind of shifted a little bit back to the Democratic Party. But now they're very, I think they're Republican. But you know,
they hate corporations. Yes. They don't like the overly rich. I mean, this is the overlap with Bernie, right? This is that piece of the,
and the question in those places really is, can Democrats just hold the margins down a little bit? I mean, like, can they still reach the voters instead of Trump or Republicans winning it by 20 points? Do they win it by 13 points, 12 points? That's everything. I mean, it's all about margins in places like this, right?
The one true swing county we have is Duval, and it really does. Duval really is sort of Maricopa East, right? I mean, how many other counties are like this? Would you put Dallas County into this? Is Dallas becoming one of these type of counties?
Dallas, the problem with Dallas, it's gotten really blue, man, at this point.
It's gotten blue too, yeah.
Yeah.
It's so rare to have a big county that truly is pretty evenly divided, where you can get both parties elected to city offices, right?
Yep.
Maricopa and Phoenix still sits that way a little bit, right?
And
Duval is definitely that. It is fascinating. Now, what happens in Duval doesn't necessarily portend to the statewide vote, but it does indicate, you know, close race. If you have a close race in Duval, you're going to have a close race statewide. That we do know.
Yeah, and I think because we talked about a little bit about this even yesterday, like so the interesting thing about Duval and Jacksonville, right? Because you know Duval is home to Jacksonville. Jacksonville's a big city. It's a really big city, but it's always been a sprawly city.
It's sprawly city. It's always been. Yeah. I think it's geographically the largest city by geography.
Yeah, that might be right. Houston's pretty massive too.
Yeah, there's some nugget where I think Jacksonville has that. They're used to certainly have that.
Because it's such a sprawly city, there are cities that we think of as cities that are really much more suburban in their feel. And this is big when a place sprawls all over and you get, you know, there's a bunch of tall buildings in the middle and then a bunch of low single family homes all around, it's going to feel more suburban. And that's what's going on.
I'm going to pause there. We'll be right back after a quick break. You're listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press. Look, the Sun Belt is where we're going to spend all our time in the next decade. Yeah. I mean, right? Like, we're starting to see that the competitiveness of the Midwest, it's still there, but it's like, I hate to say it, put it in college football terms, it's like comparing the SEC and the Big Ten. One is a power on the rise, and one is the power on the demise. That doesn't mean any given year one isn't. Matter more, right? You know, Michigan and Wisconsin still are huge battleground states. Ohio State still can force their way into the playoff.
Yep.
But boy, all the competition's down south.
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing too, though. As we move south, because I think you're right, there's like all these battlegrounds in the south over the next decade. What does that mean to me? And this goes a little bit outside of county to county. But, you know, listen, this
we're 20 minutes in. We can go.
Climate change and the environment, these issues are going to become very, very, very important because you look at all the places that are adding population. It's always places in the Sun Belt. What do we know about those places? They're getting hotter. They're getting more severe weather. I mean, so they're
they have water. Look at Phoenix. How are they going to get everybody drinking water?
Absolutely.
Right? You know, none of these places have what I would call usable public transportation, you know, they've all tried.
Right.
But you know, it's, you know, part of it is you can't dig a base. It's hard to dig tunnels in Florida and stuff like that. I mean, it ain't easy. But
once sprawl, I mean, less density means mass transit's harder just because you got more people spread out.
Climate change is going to feel like we need more of it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, again, there's all these tensions. Look, it's the next couple decades. We're going to deal with a lot of change in this country. It's going to be tough to watch.
Let me ask you this. What's the next, you know, if I were to look at a next demographic trend that I want to watch, you know, one that we're going to see a little bit of it. You know, for me, it's sort of how long, the long-term thing that I'm looking for is how long, you know, how secular is the Democratic Party going to get? And what does that mean to more religious minorities who they've counted on, particularly African Americans and the Black church, as the party gets more secular in its leadership and all of this stuff? And really the reverse, right? How long is business going to feel like they should lean right? You know, it's sort of those to me are the two larger curiosities I have as this realignment continues.
Mm-hmm.
It's figuring out, how long can the business community feel comfortable on the right?
Yep.
And we know that some of them are less comfortable every day because of social issues and business issues.
Yep.
And how long are religious voters going to feel comfortable in the Democratic Party?
I think those are really good questions. And I think the other thing when you talk about the religious aspect of the Democratic Party is the Hispanic vote.
Yep.
Because I'll tell you something, if we talk about the Catholic vote in this country, some people have asked me about the Catholic vote before. It's like, don't bother even think about the Catholic vote because it's so complicated depending on where you are.
It doesn't white really... Catholic vote.
Right.
And then don't forget, then there's white Catholics who go to church on a weekly basis and white Catholics who don't go to church.
Culturally.
On a
Catholics.
Monthly basis.
Right. Right. Yes.
You have to be, you know, just finding out someone's Catholic doesn't tell you enough about about who they are.
Yeah. And this is just a good data download in the future because I looked at this once. The Catholic Church east and the west of the east of the Mississippi and the Catholic Church west of the Mississippi are two completely different churches.
Oh, it's so true. It's radically very Latino,
different. Yeah, radically different.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Very Latino west of Mississippi.
That's a fascinating thing to me. And then I think your point about business is really interesting to me because I think already a lot of big businesses are not comfortable with the social stands that some of the social stands the Republican Party is taking. And look, there's another aspect to this. The Democratic Party in general is increasingly picking up college-educated voters. Whatever, fine. You know what else college-educated voters are? They're voters with more money. You know what that means for a business? That means those are customers they want. So it just gets, there's just like all these demographic shifts that we're seeing within the vote have all these other implications. So what do you do if you're a big business and like you need to target people who families who make over 150,000 or 100 and your primary customer is over 150,000, over $170,000 in the household. You're going to have to do something that comports to the political. You can't be siding with political views that are going to make those people uncomfortable. It just gets really interesting. The politics, again, like 10 years ago, people asked me about politics and I said, just get ready for a really bumpy decade. And now it's 10 years later. And all I'm saying is like, it's going to get bumpier. Just get ready for a really, really bumpy 10 years.
You know, one of the things I like to say is that we're, you know, why we do this by county is because the American electorate, you know, we're going through a massive realignment.
Yep.
And every 2 years, the music stops, but that doesn't mean the realignment has stopped. You know, do you have any idea of when this realignment sort of pauses? Like, I feel like we haven't paused. You know, it's not paused yet. You know, I guess it's when Trump fades. I don't know. I mean, is that the next shoe to drop? Here that maybe that's when we may hit the pause button here for a little bit.
I think when we sort through how lasting these changes that Trump has ushered in are, which we don't know yet, when we sort through that, we might hit at least a respite where it's like, okay, maybe this is the new normal for the next 5-6 years. But it just feels like, we kind of need to get all the way through the Hispanic votes evolving. So we kind of need 10 years for that to kind of evolve. Cause we did something in data download a couple of weeks ago on this about the rural Hispanic
voters. Hispanic voters feel like this, they just feel like they're about to split into majority, meaning they're just going to break down the way our majority breaks down.
It's it's going to look increasingly like what we expect out of the white vote, and like there's an urban rural divide, there's an educational divide. That stuff's all starting to appear with the Hispanic vote now.
But that seems to matter more than the ethnicity does.
Yes, I think we're going to need another 10 years to sort through that. I think we're not done with this sorting by college education yet. That's still going to like Delaware County. I talked to Dasha Burns, who's been doing reporting in Delaware, and. You know, she said, you know, I feel like Delaware is where Kent County, which is one of her first county counties. She feels like, I feel like this is where Kent County was like 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I'm like, that's not far off. Like, it feels similar to me too.
Well, this is why we do, it's so funny. It's like our reporters are getting, and it's one of these things with county to county, like the minute you spend 5 minutes with what we're doing, you're like, oh, well, this is the only way to do this. You know, it is one of those things like, you know, at first glance, you're like, oh, this feel. And it's like, no, when you realize it, this is the easiest way to eat the elephant, right? Yeah. One bite at a time, right? You know, one county at a time. And it really does help paint a picture, you know? And you can't paint the whole picture without starting somewhere.
Well, the Chinese proverb, you know, may you live in interesting times. We live in very interesting times politically. This stuff is all in motion. This wasn't true. Look, 20 years ago, this wasn't really true. We hadn't hit this point yet. Then something happened like between 2004 and 2008.
I totally agree.
We were really got in motion. Yeah.
I would argue we were pretty stable from I would argue 88 to 04.
Yeah.
And beginning with the 04 election. Which still sort of broke along more 90s lines than 21st century lines, although we saw the beginnings of it, right?
Yep.
You know, but 04 was the last election that Democrats didn't carry either Virginia or Colorado, right? And they were the first, that was the first sign that that education was going to become a more important dividing line.
Yep,
absolutely. I remember my favorite stat in 04 is the only two, there were 10, the 10 most educated states in America, 8 of them were carried by Kerry. The only two that weren't were Virginia and Colorado. And then you know what happened, right?
Really like, blue, you know, now, man. Yeah. Yeah.
It sort of really, at this point, only New Hampshire in that group of states in the top 10 on education, I think, is competitive anymore.
I think that's right. And it feels like it's moving too, though. It does. And I will say,
well, there's a reason Chris Sununu is a vaccine mandate guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
It looks sometimes more like Charlie Baker than he does either of his father or brother. You know, it is. Chris Sununu feels like a guy who's looked at the electorate and says, ah, I know what a Republican is now here in New Hampshire. Right. And it's absolutely different than it ain't Mackie Loeb. It ain't the Manchester Union leader. And
that's
knows,
right. Yeah. One other thing, by the way, very interesting. 2004. You know where there was real movement? Washoe County. It was the first time, but when I was going back and looking at the results, like Washoe went for Bush in 2000 and went for Kerry in 2004, which if
that
you remember,
was the canary.
Was
the canary.
That's a really, and if you remember back to that election, the fact that move, that told you, that was telling something was going on. That
something
was
else was happening.
Yeah.
And it was the beginning where, you know, Nevada had a nice run. You know, Nevada has had a sneaky successful run at being with the presidential winner.
Yeah.
It's in that top 3 or 4. It's not quite it may actually be the lead state now.
It might be because you were probably thinking of Ohio, which is not anymore.
Yeah.
Ohio,
now, Nevada, obviously Trump didn't carry Nevada in 16, but he came close.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It is, but it was the last streak that I think died on the Trump front.
Yep.
And then I guess Ohio died. No, Ohio's streak finally ended in 2020, right?
That's right. Because it went with Trump.
They had been with the winner
Trump in 2016. That's right.
60. Yeah. So Ohio streak finally ended there. So anyway.
And it is, and just one more, just throw another plug for our counties here. So Ohio goes for Trump in 2016, goes for Trump in 2020 by almost the exact same margin. I think it was 8 points, both elections.
Right.
Delaware County swings heavily Democratic. I mean, it still goes for Trump, but the shift is, 9 points? It shifted 9 points Democratic. Again, so even as the state looks stable, Trump wins it by 8 points in 2016. Trump wins it by 8 points in 2020. There's all this movement going on underneath, and Delaware County is one of the places we saw it.
Well, it's interesting. So in Ohio, they could lose ground in Delaware County and make it up in other places.
That's right.
In Georgia, Chattooga, where Donald Trump gained a vote from 16 to 20.
Yep.
In a state, he won the state in 16, lost the state in 20, even though he gained in his own areas, shows you what happened in the Atlanta suburbs. That's for sure.
Yeah, you know, the reason he could lose in Ohio and still hold steady there was because there are all these blue collar suburban areas around Cleveland that came through for him.
Yep.
Those don't exist in Georgia. So when he lost in suburban Atlanta and he lost those exurban areas around Atlanta, there wasn't some big blue collar, like there wasn't a Youngstown or there wasn't a suburban Cleveland to come bail him
out. The exurbs are more diverse in Atlanta than they are in Cleveland. And that's the issue.
Oh yeah. Yes. Also higher rates of college education, which obviously always made a big difference.
Now. Right. Now, no, anyway. It's why the Republicans don't perform well in Virginia's exurbs and the Northern Virginia exurbs as they do in others. Because again, those exurbs are more diverse, and as you said, more diversity usually comes more college education. Anyway.
Yep.
Dante. The man behind our Kennedy County project. How many classifications of counties do you have these days? We're up to 15 at one point.
We have 15. We still were stopping. We will not go above 15 at the American Communities Project.
I mean, if you really want to get lost in some great data, and I do this every once in a while, the problem is when I go into the American Communities Project, that's an hour. it's a good hour. It's a smart hour. It's an hour. It's great stuff. So I encourage you, if you're into the data world and you really want to understand the American electorate, I would argue doing it by county is much better than doing it by poll. All right, Mr. Chinney.
Thank you, sir.
Your Spartans gonna beat the Wolverines at least.
I don't.
That's really all that matters.
I don't talk about such insignificant matters. All I want to say is I just hope the best team wins, and the best team will definitely be wearing green on Saturday.
Wow! No trash talk. Is it because Ohio State just pummels both of you, and you guys just don't have any talking points?
I will throw out just as a point. I have no idea what's going to happen Saturday. Usually, I have some idea. This Michigan State game, I have no idea this week. Zero idea what the heck's going to happen. I do think, however, both these teams are going to get trounced by Ohio State, which bumps me out because it looks like they've got their mojo back. And
I do is I look forward to betting against the team that wins this game because Ohio State won't be favored by as many points as they should be. That's sort of the way I look at it as a degenerate gambler.
That's what I was going to say. That's the gambler's approach to this.
Degenerate gambler's approach. Anyway.
Who do you have this weekend? I'm just curious really quickly.
We have Pitt, which right now... Pitt and Wake. Right now, if the ACC ended today, it'd be undefeated Wake Forest Demon Deacons and the Pitt Panthers, who did win a national title with Tony Dorsett. So they're Wake Forest, you know, home to before Chris Paul and God, I'm drawing a blank on our friend from San Antonio. Why am I drawing a blank on the great basketball player? From San Antonio with David Robinson, a Demon Deacon. God, this is embarrassing.
Oh, Tim Duncan.
Tim Duncan, of course.
Yeah.
But before those two, Arnold Palmer was their best athlete. You know, so Wake Forest didn't produce, you know. Anyway, Miami is Pitt. I don't know. The ACC is filled with mediocrity, man. Anybody can beat anybody any week. And it's both fun, I guess, if you care about that stuff. It's demoralizing if you're like me and think that Miami has no business being mediocre. So other than that, I feel great about college football. But I'm hanging with Manny Diaz because I don't want to see more coaching changes. Enough of the coaching changes. Give him a chance. Give him a chance to fail on his own. Don't assume failure before it's done. Anyway. All right. Thank you, Dante.
Very good, sir.
Matt, let me rant there, man.
Yeah. See you soon.
You've been listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Gilpin Green and Matt Rivera.
John Reese is our executive producer, and our theme music is composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily every day on MSNBC at 1 p.m. Eastern. Meet the Press reports is on demand on Peacock, and the big show is available every Sunday morning on every platform you can think of. So thanks for listening, and until we upload again.